There are few things that rub me the wrong way more than the Olympic Games. The hyper-nationalism, the single-mindedness, the commercialism that has become part and parcel of the festivities, not to mention the cheating, all of the things that glorify competition at the expense of collaboration. The Olympics seem to exemplify that the human race would rather spend time and energy proving personal superiority rather than working together toward the common good. Now, don't get me wrong, much of the athleticism is breathtaking, even beautiful. It's really the propaganda of the games that gives me pause. Nonetheless, I have to admit that this summer I was glued to the television. I actually own videotapes. Yes, I still have some videotapes of opening ceremonies. Even though we know that he was lip-syncing, I must admit that when Pavarotti belted out Nessun Dorma at the games in Italy, I was speechless. Vincerò! I can't do it. Maybe one of you could. It gives me goosebumps. Even more deeply seared in my brain are the opening ceremonies from the 1998 Winter Games in Nagano. The finale began with a chorus of beautiful Japanese voices singing Beethoven's Ode to Joy. They sang it in glorious, crisp, clear tones. And I remember just letting that music wash over me, even while my inner critic critiqued the fact that the games were in Japan, the music was German, and they were singing English lyrics. Then, slowly, the TV cameras panned to a jumbotron. And on that jumbotron, you could see another choir singing along. As the camera panned out, I realized that the choir, that second choir, was standing on the steps of the Gutenberg Cathedral in Germany. There was a satellite that was beaming the audio and video in real time so that these two choirs could sing together from across the globe. Courtney will tell you how hard it is to get two choirs to sing together and be in sync on different corners of this room. But we had two choirs singing in unison. Then the TV panned to another jumbotron, and there we saw another choir singing simultaneously from the steps of the Sydney Opera House. Then another from the steps of the UN in New York. The final choir to chime in was on the Cape of Good Hope, and it was the first black and white choir to sing together for an official state function in South Africa since the fall of apartheid. And they had timed it just right so that as this choir began singing the hymn of praise and thanksgiving just as the sun began to rise on a new day. It was breathtaking. Choirs on every inhabited continent singing in unison by virtue of human technology. It was truly a celebration of all that human beings can achieve. While I love the opening ceremonies because of their pageantry, even they leave me with a nagging sense of unease. Thank you, Jason. Thanks so much. The Olympics lift up so much of what our culture glorifies. Power, strength, bravado, single-mindedness, confidence, prestige, victory. In his book, On Paradise Drive, New York Times columnist David Brooks describes this as the achievatron, that modernist social construct that human beings can do it all. winning and conquering rule the day at the Olympics, setting up what I like to suggest is a false dichotomy in life, really. You win or you lose. You're a success or you fail. As a counterpoint to the Achievatron and the Olympian, the Bible offers us Jacob. I'd like to suggest that in the passage from Genesis that we read today, we receive a much more credible witness as to how life really works than the Olympics could ever show us. Yes, Jacob is our model. That's right, Jacob, who, like the subprime mortgage broker, swindles his brother Esau out of his birthright by giving him a bowl of chili. Jacob, who pulls the wool over his father Isaac's eyes in order to swindle him into a blessing. Jacob, who works for 7 years in Laban's camp in order to earn Rachel's hand in marriage, only to be tricked himself into marrying Leah instead. Yeah, Jacob. He's our model. Jacob is our model because we can relate to Jacob. While many of us will not be tricking our families into naming us as sole heirs anytime soon, we can definitely relate to the situation in which Jacob finds himself in Genesis 32. He has just led his father-in-law's home after some shady dealings, just to find out that his brother, whom he wronged years ago, is waiting for him just over the next hills. Jacob, like the manager that we heard about it last week in the gospel, Jacob is between a rock and a hard place. His past is catching up with him, and there's nowhere to go. No matter which way he turns, he's going to have to face his past. That, my friends, that is something that many of us will have to deal with at some point in our lives. And so today, Jacob takes a stand. He doesn't cut corners. He doesn't take cheap shots. He doesn't give up. He doesn't make excuses. He isn't all bluster and bravado. He doesn't rely on cunning or excuses or deceit. Instead, he sends his wealth and his entourage across the river ahead of him. And so he is vulnerable. He is completely alone. Tonight, he is not going to rely on possessions or power. He knows that if he is going to engage his past, only he can do it. Now, before we go any further, it might be helpful to take a closer look at the text. So let's turn to Genesis 32 in our Bibles on page 30 of the Old Testament. In verses 25 and 26, we read that some man wrestled with Jacob throughout the night. Again, that's verses 25 and 26. Some man wrestled with Jacob throughout the night. Traditions abound as to exactly who it is that wrestles with Jacob, but I would like to suggest that the person that Jacob wrestles with is God. The reason I subscribe to this reading of the text is the name that the wrestler gives Jacob. Israel means struggles with God. In the end, when we are finally ready to face our past, only God is such a worthy adversary. Only when we have wrestled all night with God can we come out at daybreak a different person than when we were when we began. Jacob, in this passage in which he finally allows himself to be vulnerable, struggles throughout the night to the point of utter exhaustion. What's powerful here, says feminist theologian Joan Chittister, is that God does not leave him there. She goes on to say that in each human struggle, there's a corresponding divine gift available to us. Conversion, independence, faith, courage, surrender, limitless endurance, transformation. Jacob does what all of us must do, writes Chittister. He confronts in himself the things that are wounding him, admits his limitations, accepts his situation, rejoins the world, and moves on. The former dean of Andover Newton Seminary, Mary Luty, says it this way. She says that this story is a story that tells us that God does not despise us for our faults and failings, but forever ambushes our lives with new chances. That God does not renege on promises, even promises made under duress. Jacob's story becomes a model for all of us, as it teaches us that unless we wrestle honestly with our grief, our failures, our sadness, we will never be able to go on to fullness of life. Contemplate, if you would, the dynamic between winning and losing in your own life, from winning or losing an argument to triumphing or failing in the workplace. So much of our world seems to pivot on winning or losing. In Jacob's wrestling match, though, the winner is unclear. Our author tells us that it was a tough fight, but we never hear who triumphed. Instead, we hear that Jacob, over whom the mystery opponent could not prevail, would not let him go until he gave him a blessing. Jacob would not let his opponent go until he blessed him. What a radical notion. Through this struggle, Jacob comes to recognize that his opponent is not to be despised, not to be demonized, but rather his opponent is one who could offer benediction. He comes to recognize that which he struggled with could be an agent of blessing. The opponent has something to offer. Jacob teaches us all that being blessed through the struggle is a much, much higher than a prize that winning could ever be. This shift in thinking from win-lose to seeking a blessing in all quarters reminds me of a conversation I had recently with a friend. He was upset, frustrated after having started his own business a few years back. He was frustrated because he'd determined that he probably was going to have to go back to the corporate world. At the center of his frustration was this thought that he thought that this meant he had failed. Jacob's wrestling with God and demanding a blessing, though, offers us an alternative reading of my friend's situation. Instead of seeing something as a failure, we need to wrestle with it honestly and then seek its blessing. In having this conversation with my friend, he was able to come to understand that some of the blessings that his business-owning adventure had allowed him were creativity and freedom and autonomy, and some of the blessings that wrestling with the corporate world would lend him would be health insurance and a 401k. He wasn't a failure. Rather, he had learned valuable lessons about the gifts that the other had to offer. That's the grace that we encounter here in the scriptures and in worship. We do not come to God in this community perfectly worthy. We come here as wrestlers, as Israelites, as people who struggle with life, with ourselves, with each other, with addictions, with God. And in a life of faith, God engages us, God ambushes us, God has been waiting for us to drop our facades, our coping mechanisms, our pride, our defenses. God is waiting for us right here and right now, waiting for us to wrestle, to struggle, but most importantly, to seek a blessing. May it be so. Amen.